We haven't heard much about safe injection sites. So let's correct that right now. It turns out the Seattle City Council has revived and revised the effort to open those sites. Here's the report from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
We first heard about safe injection sites way back in 2016 when the King County Heroin and Opioid Task Force recommended opening at least two in the county to help fight the rise in deadly overdoses. But many cities quickly opted out, leaving Seattle set on opening a single site. But ongoing opposition, difficulty finding a location, and legal concerns have kept the plan on perpetual hold. But the city council has had over $1 million tucked away for it for years. And recently, some of the advocates for the sites decided it was time to figure out another way to get these up and running.
So unsafe consumption or unsupervised consumption is made safer.
Jesse Rollins with the Public Defender Association and an addiction policy expert who helped rework the proposal.
To implement safer supervised consumption services at existing social service locations.
And he says there's a clear need.
Since the Heroin and Prescription Opiate Addiction Task Force made their recommendations in September of 2016, strictly inside Seattle, there have been 754 individuals that have passed away from overdose. Countywide, 14% of overdose rates in 2019 were affected by people experiencing homelessness.
Here's how it would work.
People would be able to consume drugs, substances that they previously had access to, places like low barrier emergency shelters for homeless folks. Already have high numbers of overdoses happening in there. It's just that their staff is trained to respond and to reverse overdoses. So we're suggesting to beef up those services, to augment social service provisions so that consumption is made safer and less harmful.
Councilmember Lisa Herbold, who's sponsoring the proposal, elaborating in yesterday's council budget meeting.
And this new approach is simply not relying on establishing constructing a new bricks and mortar location to provide these services.
And she stressed this is not a new proposal.
Despite rumors to the contrary, this is not a new effort. This is our ongoing effort, many years long now, dating back to 2018, to support and appropriate funding for community health engagement locations. These are locations where under supervision, narcotics can be used with access to key health and social services in order to reduce and promote health, including but not limited to overdose prevention.
Several council members signed on in support of the plan, including Shama Sawant, but not before making this point.
This is another example of funding that Mayor Durkin has year after year failed to actually use funds that have been allocated by the city council's budget decision. The original allocation of that $1.4 million was a budget amendment fought for and won by the People's Budget Movement. After it was allocated, the mayor shamefully refused to use those funds while opiate addiction spread in the city, in the region, and in the country. So I would really urge the mayor to stop delaying the investment of these funds.
Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda had similar frustration.
This has been one of those issues that was present when I first got sworn in. Here we are working on it for the last year of my first term here. So,
the mayor's office has told the Seattle Times that Mayor Durkin is interested in seeing how it could work, looking at this plan. For now, the idea of moving that money to a dedicated program in partnership with public health is still on the table as the council finishes up work on the budget. On the issue of the budget, today we'll get a first look at what the city council members want when it comes to defunding SPD. Remember, there's that early commitment to some communities of color about cutting the SPD budget by 50%, at least. But according to documents filed last night for today's SPD budget proposal session, it looks to add up to only about 21%. Including another 35 job cuts and other changes. The council will take that up this afternoon.
Hannah, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think what most people wonder about the safe injection sites is, will it do anything to get the tents out of their neighborhoods? Will it?
You know, that's the hope. If you go and you have people in those that use those types of locations, maybe they get into treatment and services, and then maybe they don't need to live in a tent anymore. But that's not the goal. The goal of the sites is always about the harm reduction. It's always about saving the lives. And as you heard Jesse say in, I think, the soundbite there, in the 4 years since the first recommendation for these sites came out in 2016, there's been more than 750 deadly overdoses, and that's a much larger increase. And I think here recently, they just had some numbers in the last week or so where the uptick is really significant. So that's the focus for those who try to push these, but it could have that effect.
Is there, there's also a sense, I think, that when you open up a safe injection site, it's a signal you've given up on rehab. Is that true?
Yeah, no, and it's not true. It's not, and again, not from the people that behind it. It's that you have to do it the other way. It's kind of, again, it's part of that harm reduction model. You have to let people do what it is they need to do, so they're more willing to deal with you. And it's better, this is better because it can save their life. It's better because they'll have sterile, you know, tools to use that are provided for them. Mm-hmm. And it keeps needles from being spread out around all over the ground outside where people, you know, everyday people can walk into them. And then they can connect them with services if they should want to, if that conversation does come up. So it's better than a forced rehab, which most people say doesn't work.
Was there anything new on this story about not prosecuting people for misdemeanors on grounds that they are impoverished?
Yes, absolutely. So that is we heard about that from Lisa Herbold earlier in the week. And that was going to be, you know, if you had a mental health symptom, if you had a drug addiction symptom, or if you had poverty, you know, if you were stealing bread to feed yourself or something along those lines, if you could just have symptoms of any of that, it would give the judges at the Seattle Municipal Court the okay to say, okay, well, we can dismiss this. And that's it. Good. You know, out you go. And there was a lot of pushback from that. So it came up at the council in discussions at budget. It's not completely off the table yet, but there was definitely some pushback. And now this was more about the fact, in part, that it was included in this budget process, which not everybody on the council agreed with. The overall sense, though, that I got was that this is a very big issue. And while there's support from like Councilmember Gonzalez, Councilmember Andrew Lewis, both of them said, let's slow down a minute and let's take a deep dive into this after we finish the budget late in November. So there's an editorial in the Times today saying that's not good. The Times editorial board is saying you can't let that happen because there's really a lot of crime that falls under that umbrella. Yeah. And it's a big concern. So I think you'll see a lot of pushback from community on this. I think that it's a good call, though, if they end up waiting till after the budget, because there's too much else going on right now in the budget.
Well, it seems like an insult to all the work being done by community groups to make sure that there are food banks accessible to everyone. Is there any indication that for some reason people can't get food?
No. This is not about that. This is about, in part, about lowering the number of people that they put in the jail so that the city can save money. Yeah. It's also about the overarching ongoing theme from Seattle to Olympia to put fewer people in jail, period, and reform the criminal justice system.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attractions.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places and things. And if you haven't picked up your Halloween candy yet, you may want to consider the historic Mountain Bar. It's been made in Pierce County for more than a century, and Felix, it once had a much more geographically specific name, didn't it?
Yeah, morning, Dave. I was at my local Bartell Drugs a few days ago, and my tear-filled eyes settled on a selection of Mountain Bars on the candy shelf. Now, are you familiar with this candy bar, Dave?
I am not.
All right, well, maybe this jingle, which was recorded especially for us by a dedicated Cairo listener in Edgewood, will refresh everyone's memory.
What's in the middle of a mountain bar? Hundreds of chocolate and peanuts.
I'm still not familiar with it.
Now, that listener told me she used to hear that jingle on the old Breakman Bill show on Channel 11 back in the 60s. Now, mountain bars date back even further than that, to 1915. They're still made in the first and only place they ever were made, the Brown and Haley factory on 26th in Tacoma. They're sold all over the Northwest. I didn't know this before, but a mountain bar wasn't what the candy was first called back in 1915. A YouTuber named The Candy Guy explains it here.
The mountain bar didn't officially get its name until 1923. Then what was it called before? It was called the Mount Tacoma. Mount Tacoma. Where's Mount Tacoma? I had no idea. So I did some research and found out that the mountain, currently known as Mount Rainier in the state of Washington, was originally called Mount Tacoma.
I thought it was called Tahoma.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. So Kathy Reniker at Brown and Haley told me earlier this week there were many variations on the name. She said there was a Tahoma bar, a Tacoma bar. They also even had a version they shipped to Seattle called the Mount Rainier bar. And in terms of the controversy over the name, Brown and Haley's pretty agnostic about whether it should be called Mount Rainier, the actual mountain now, not the bar. Now, there's three flavors. There's original, which is vanilla, cherry, which was originally called a cherry bounce, but became a mountain bar back in the 20s, and then peanut butter, which is the junior member of the trio, which only dates to 1972. They've had some limited edition flavors in the past, like raspberry and coconut, that kind of thing. Now, there's been a battle raging on social media over the last couple days about which flavor is best. Kathy Reniker says Spokane is the biggest market for mountain bars, and Eastern Washington folks prefer the cherry. So they're not exactly mountain bar originalists, but the progressives here in Western Washington prefer the peanut butter by far over the other one. So there is a not only a regional candy bar, but it has geographic differences. There was one more flavor they used to sell. It was just at the factory only. It was chocolate with no filling. It was some kind of byproduct of when they first fired up the production line, and they don't make those anymore, unfortunately. But it's a great classic Northwest bar, and if you want to give out some big candy bars for Halloween this year, it's a perfect sort of Northwest-friendly choice.
There you go. And it's a much better name than the byproduct bar.
Yeah. Oh, and we have some photos of the old packaging at My Northwest, too.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's begin in Washington, D.C. with Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan. All of the public polling ahead of Election Day suggests, I emphasize that word, a win for Joe Biden. But after 2016, should anyone believe the polls?
I believe the polling, but I believe as well the Trump campaign when they say that they think their voters don't necessarily respond to polls and may not be measured. They argued that in 2016. They're arguing that now. They also argue that their supporters will show up en masse day of and vote in person in a way that could narrow that divide that you currently see. Joe Biden does have that edge. He certainly has the edge with the early vote. And the Trump campaign is saying they can make up for that with in-person votes on Election Day. So we know what polls indicate, but it comes down to whether people do what they say.
I'm curious, is that in-person vote a deliberate strategy or just the way things happen to shake out? Because it seems risky to me. If there turns out to be, you know, huge lines, 2, 3, 4 hours, there's always the danger that a lot of those people give up.
That's true. And that it just is a matter of preference or requirement for some. I mean, behaviorally, yes, Republicans tend to vote closer to Election Day. But what's so unusual this year is in the midst of the pandemic, this surge in early in-person and mail-in voting in particular in places where that wasn't previously available. The pandemic has kind of changed the model for so many people. It's hard to say what is predictable these days, given it's 2020. So while the Trump campaign is talking about those voters showing up in person, I don't know if it's an actual strategy. It may just be behavior. Also, keep in mind, the president has really discouraged mail-in voting, making these unfounded claims about mail fraud, even though he has endorsed absentee ballots.
On the issue of voter suppression, I saw a story that the Trump campaign has sent officials to some of these early voting sites to videotape voters. I think in some cases they were trying to stop people who appeared to be delivering more than one ballot to a drop box, which bothered me because I mean we vote by mail here, and I sent my wife to take both of our ballots down to the box to drop them in, which is allowed in this state. Is any of that going to end up being a serious threat, or are these just individual anecdotes?
At this point, it looks like individual anecdotes, but it's something that is being watched very carefully by the local authorities in many of these states. The Trump campaign has said they want to have poll watchers, which are allowed at districts, just like Democrats do. But there is this concern that supporters could sort of self-appoint themselves and interfere. And doing that, intimidating voters, is a crime. So that is something that local authorities are going to make clear. There is a lot of apprehension. There's a lot of concern over what could go wrong this year. And what you are hearing repeatedly from federal officials is that it's dangerous to undermine the public's confidence in the vote, that federal authorities in particular have put together the biggest operation ever to head off at Homeland Security, cyber interference in particular, and that they are going to be watching voter intimidation as well. So the hope is that these anecdotes you're talking about don't discourage people from actually exercising the right to vote.
Of course, it's not just the White House that's up for grabs. The Democrats seem to be talking seriously about taking the Senate. I mean, I'm looking at the Lindsey Graham looks like he's in a horse race, but Mitch McConnell looks pretty secure. I mean, do they have a realistic chance of doing that?
This is going to be fascinating to watch. Do Republicans successfully hold on to their very slim majority in the Senate? It looks like it's in play right now because of some key states. You mentioned places like South Carolina where you wouldn't think that a seat was in play. You know, Lindsey Graham has Strom Thurmond's seat in South Carolina. It has gone to a Republican for 55 years. The idea that a Democrat, Jamie Harrison, could be closing in is incredible. So just the fact that you see some of these states in play raises eyebrows and says, wow, this really could be a game changer for the Senate. Now, why does that matter? Well, no matter who is elected president, they have to be able to work with the Senate, in particular the House as well, to craft laws. President Trump, even with a Republican majority, only had one massive piece of legislation go through. That was his tax bill in 2017. He and the Republican leadership haven't been in agreement on a lot. So if he gets a second term, he's going to have to figure out possibly how to deal with a Democratic majority. Does he get to strike the deals he campaigned on and wasn't able to deliver in his first term? Joe Biden is promising the sun, the moon, and the stars, many of which requires him to have a Democratic majority in the Senate to do things like the kind of overhauls of health care that he is promising. So this could be either the brakes on a presidency or the grease on the wheels of a presidency to make some big change. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
Margaret Brennan, the host of Face the Nation. As the COVID-19 surge continues here in Washington, we have a strong word of warning from health officials this Halloween weekend. Here is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
The numbers just aren't getting any better. Nearly 1,600 new coronavirus cases reported by the state health officials over the past 2 days, and several more deaths. Washington has now seen a total of nearly 106,000 coronavirus cases, and 2,359 people have died. The message from health officials as we head into the Halloween weekend, please wear a mask, limit gatherings. The virus, they say, is now spreading among pretty much all age groups, many times due to people just hanging out at home with friends or others who they don't live with. Some cases are also spreading among people who do live together. Others are happening at workplaces. And there's significant concern that an even larger spike could be on the way. The latest UW Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation modeling suggests the U.S. could see a significant surge in cases and deaths over the next 2 to 3 weeks. Among the most concerning locations in the state, Snohomish County. County Health Officer Dr. Chris Spitters.
COVID does affect different populations to different degrees, and we're seeing that many of the racial and ethnic minority groups in Snohomish County are disproportionately affected. In particular, Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders at rates 8 to 9 times what whites and Asians are seeing, but also African Americans, American Indian, Alaskan Natives 2 times higher and Latinos 4 times higher than what whites are experiencing.
Meantime, in King County,
the virus clearly has the home field advantage right now, and we need to step up our game big time.
Dr. Jeff Duchin.
The countywide positivity rate has increased from approximately 2% in September to 3% recently, and this reflects increasing transmission, not just more testing. Over 1/3 of our cases are related to community activities and travel, socializing, gathering with friends and family, parties, weddings, and other celebrations, visiting bars and restaurants, even faith-based activities.
Many schools have already slowed their ideas for bringing kids back to school early, but there is some hope in Pierce County, where they are part of a $7.8 million pilot program that comes from federal CARES dollars for a COVID-19 rapid testing pilot so students can keep going to class. It will bring rapid COVID testing to all of the kindergartners and first graders in Peninsula and a couple of other districts, and allow the district to bring second graders back to class next month. The hope is that rapid testing could eventually help all schools reopen. And as the state continues to prepare for an eventual vaccine, the state health department is now asking health care providers to prepare to enroll as approved COVID-19 vaccine providers. Letters have been sent out to all health care providers in the state. Long-term care facilities can also enroll. The health department says part of the reason is that this week they got a letter from the Department of Health and Human Services about a new vaccine preparation timeline and some planning requests. In that letter, they said they might pre-position some of the vaccine supply closer to the sites where it's going to be administered so it can get out there to the community quicker. The state health department says they were also asked to be ready for that to happen by November 15th. They stress that doesn't mean that it will happen, just that they're being asked to be ready. So really just a cautionary tale as you head into your Halloween weekend and we get into these months of the holidays ahead. Health officials say they want you to have a good time on Halloween, but they want you to be careful. So you need to wear your mask, stay out of confined spaces, try to social distance, and limit your gatherings.
Anna Scott.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. A 12-year-old boy in Iowa is using his love of baseball to help storm victims. CBS's Chip Reed has that story.
Few kids have ever stepped up to the plate for charity like Tommy Romberg.
I just wanted to raise money so we could help them rebuild.
Rebuild from the massive derecho that hit Iowa in August. A friend's birthday was upended, too.
I knew his favorite sport was baseball, and I thought it'd mean a lot to him if he got a baseball bat for his birthday.
So Tommy decided to make him one by hand and called it the Great Derecho. When word got out, others wanted homemade bats, too, including his mother, Amanda.
I kind of thought, oh, shoot, Tommy, I think I would like one. Would you make me one? And he told me no. He still had blisters on his hands.
But it gave Tommy an idea. What if he made bats out of wood brought down by the storm and donated some of the profits to storm victims? His family bought a lathe, and so far, he's made about 100 bats and raised more than $2,500.
I feel like it's really helping people.
Tommy makes the bats after he's done his homework and on the days he's doing school virtually.
One of the reasons that he can spend all this time doing this is because he's home from school.
I almost feel like this is school in itself, you know.
And he's certainly got a hit on his hands. Chip Reed, CBS News, Washington.
I wonder if he ever ended up making his mom a bat. She asked for one.
Yeah.
Sweet kid.
It's a nice thing to do. And it's fun. You ever worked with a lathe?
No.
Yep.
Yeah.
They're fun.
Yeah. A little dangerous, though.
Yeah, I'm out.
Yeah.
No, thanks.
Oh, yeah.
Here is G. Scott. It's a Blue Friday. Seahawks are in first place. Not undefeated, but in first place. And it was you, G, who expressed serious concerns about Arizona, and you were certainly right about that, even though you got the score wrong. What do you think about the 49ers?
You had to throw in, I got the score wrong. That's good.
Well, full disclosure, this is a journalistic enterprise.
Same. There's concern here with the 49ers coming here. Yeah, it's not the rivalry that it once was when Harbaugh was the head coach and he wore those khakis on the sideline. But it's still a rivalry nonetheless, considering it's in the NFC West division. Here's the thing about this Niners team. They kind of struggled early, but they're starting to get their bearings, if you will, a little bit. They're starting to understand who they are and their identity as a team. And who they are is they're kind of a run-first team with an offensive line that's pretty good, pretty decent. Their quarterback, Garoppolo, is someone who is very overpaid. And
he's overpaid?
For sure. He makes a lot of money, Dave. But
does he make more than Russell Wilson does?
I don't know if he's up there. I don't know quite yet. He just kind of fell in line with the next man up. You know, that's how the quarterback market is going. But here's the thing about Garoppolo. What they've done now is like, look, we're not going to have you throwing the ball because that's not really your strong suit. So we're going to take that out of your hands. We're going to kind of run the ball a little bit. We're going to rely on our defense, if you will, and we're going to do the best that we can. And the Niners have started to get things together. Here's the problem. History has shown us this season so far that the Seahawks defense has allowed mediocre quarterbacks to be phenomenal and fantastic. When Cam Newton was here and the New England Patriots were here, I thought, oh my goodness, this Cam Newton is like going to be setting the world on fire. Cam Newton is back. Ever since Cam Newton played against the Seahawks, Cam Newton has left the building. You know what I mean? So what's happened is with this defense, mediocre quarterbacks have been pretty good. Matt Ryan with the Atlanta Falcons, first game of the season, he was really good against the Seahawks. So I'm afraid that on Sunday that Garoppolo could have a really good game when he hasn't been really that good. And he's
let me
been
see if I'm understanding what you're saying.
Mediocre.
The San Francisco has put its eggs into the running game. And so they're really good at that. But now you're saying because of our defense, they could have both a killer running game and a killer passing
well,
game.
So here's what I don't want to do. Yeah, I'm kind of saying that, Dave. Right. But I don't want to take shots at our defense because, look, the Seahawks are still 5-1.
Right? And they're bigger than you.
And they're bigger than me, right. Yeah, absolutely right. They are 5-1. One thing about this defense, the Seattle Seahawks defense, is this. Yes, they haven't been that great, but they've been great when it matters. So they've done a lot of that. And so they're trying to get things back. I'm sure they know better than all of us know what they need to do to be better on defense. I just think that this is a very important game. Like you said earlier, it's a must win. Every game in the NFL is a must win, but especially this game. This is a division game. This is considering that the Seahawks just lost down in Arizona. So to come back up here and be at home. Now, of course, there's no crowd, right? So yeah, right. Usually the Seahawks would count on that crowd to kind of help them. Well, it's going to be silence there. And even though I believe Russell Wilson plays even better when it's silence, because he's really that good, but it is important.
Is Richard Sherman
game.
Still with the 49ers?
He is with the 49ers right now. Brother Sherm has a little bit of a leg injury, so he's been out a lot of games, and he won't be playing in this game on Sunday. But here's the thing about what Richard Sherman has done. Richard Sherman has been really good, a really good leader for that secondary, for those defensive backs, the guys that play defense, that get the interceptions, because those guys have been playing really good as of late. And, you know, I'm not saying that Richard Sherman is the reason, but I am saying that Richard Sherman is very vocal and has been a great leader for them for the last three seasons.
And Carlos Dunlap, can you give us a brief update on him?
Yo, Carlos Dunlap is the new person that the Seahawks just acquired just now to play help with this defense. And here's something special about this dude. This dude, he left college. He left college in 2010, went back in 2016, and got his degree. You know, like, hey, look, guys, I really commend these athletes that go pro and then say, hey, you know what? For whatever reason that they do it, they go back and get their college degree. But this Dunlap dude, not only did he go get his college degree, he went and got his master's, Dave.
All right. In what?
I don't even know.
Business administration.
Yeah. Well, why you set me up like that, man?
Well,
yeah.
I thought you
knew. You set me up, man.
All right. Give me the score. What's your score?
Oh.
Come on.
Okay, here we go. It's I'm going back 31-27. That's what I said last week.
31-27. Didn't work last week. Maybe it'll work this
week. Oh, Dave. You get me on this Friday. Oh, hello, Miley Katie.
Yeah.
Hello, G. Scott.
There she is. G. Scott with Ursula at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. Thanks,
right,
G.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.